The Market Musings Podcast.
Hello and welcome to Stockbox. Today's Market Musings Podcast, we're joined by John Teeling, the chairman of Arkell Resources PLC. Now, Arkell Resources is listed on the stock exchange. It's an active explorer for lithium in Botswana, Ireland and Zimbabwe, zinc in Ireland and gold in Ireland. Now, they have just released an interim statement for the period ending June 2024. Hi, John. Great to have you with us today.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good.
Lovely. Well, you've raised some very interesting points in your statement for the whole of the mining sector, in fact. Now, I quote from your chairman's statement, "The green revolution is in full swing. By 2050, we are supposed to be carbon neutral." Now, you continue to say, "Not for the first time, I write about the inability of politicians, bureaucrats, and the Greens to grasp the simple fact that the transition to the green economy requires vast quantities of metals such as lithium, copper, nickel, etc. These must be mined," you say. Now, what is the picture with the politicians?
I don't blame only the politicians.
Of course.
I think the bureaucrats are as bad. And indeed, maybe people in general do not understand. The green transition cannot be stopped and will not be stopped. It'll get there sooner or later. I don't know the details and nobody else does either. And it's not a bad thing. It's a very good thing to happen. But it must happen in the context of the world evolving the way it is. And people get on hobby horses. And indeed, even some corporate executives get on these hobby horses as well. And if you want green transitions, if you want any new technologies, you have to have the various parts that go into it. And everything we do is required to be mined. Almost everything, if it isn't mining, it's hydrocarbons. It's plastics, it's petrol, it's things like that. You cannot have the green transition unless you develop or build something towards it. And a lot of the technologies are only evolving. But these are all going to require piles and piles and piles of metals. Now, the very obvious one, and the one we're in, is lithium, because the green transition for certainly for transport requires batteries, and indeed for wind and solar energy, because the sun doesn't shine at night and the wind doesn't blow when you want. For instance, today here in Ireland is looking at, we've no wind. It's virtually windless.
There's no sun here in the UK.
There's no sun here either. So there's no sun, no wind. And yet the other times the grid gets overpowered by the wind brief report. So you need battery storage, which is happening very fast. Now, batteries require lithium. I've made that statement so often, and other people have, and nobody seems to believe it. It's incredible. It really amazes me. 90% of all the lithium metal is produced in China, and yet the rest of the world is the one that is advocating the green transition. And batteries require lithium. That has to be found. Hence, we are in Arkell, we're in lithium and a sister company as well. It just has to be. And that technology is only new. Lithium mining and brines is only a new technology. It too has to evolve to provide these minerals. And likewise, everything else where we're sitting, where we're looking, requires base metals, iron, copper, particularly copper, because you can't have electric wires without copper. What's bothering me is I don't understand why other people don't see that.
Yeah. Why do you think that is, John?
I really don't. I've been involved recently in this critical metals program from the EU. And the EU have identified 33 critical metals, most of the ones we're involved in, thank God, that they have to have. And they are going to have very good programs, really good programs, to promote the development of these minerals. And they're going to fund it because venture capital and bonds and funding is very hard to get in mining and has been for a while because it's out of favor. And yet, I've looked at it and I was involved with an Irish government project here and I went to the meeting and I stood up and I said, well, I think this is excellent, but where is the mention of exploration? And there isn't. If you look through it, there is no mention of exploration either in the European one or in the United States one. And without exploration, there can't be any mines. Mines are short-lived, most of them, not all of them. Yeah. But most mines only have a life of maybe 20 or 30 years. That means even if it's 20 years from now, it's only to 2044. So a lot of the mines in operation now will be gone. A lot of the lithium mines are short really short-lived hard rock lithium, which is high cost and won't survive that long at all. There's plenty of lithium in the world, but you have to find it, and you have to mine it, and you have to turn it into metal. And the same with copper. I don't know, probably most of your listeners will not be aware that copper is a fabulous metal, but it's really large scale, really large scale. If you find copper deposit, takes a few years. It can cost, can take 10 to 15 years and cost billions, literally billions of dollars to bring it on stream as a big copper mine. I don't see the realization by anybody. Now, because of course, it's not sexy to do that. Yeah. Politicians don't want to say we can't do it. Bureaucrats, I don't understand bureaucrats because I'm not one. They don't see it either. And as a consequence, then the young 18-year-olds with fire in their eyes, well, great, if that's what we want. They don't worry about that. It'll all be fixed. Just stop oil, stop mining, and everything will be all right. Sure. Not a hope in hell. It just can't happen. And they're ignoring the fact that the global south, the West is declining. The US is declining. The rest of the world is growing really fast, parts of it, and will continue to grow really fast. Africa is going to become, they estimate that maybe in 50 years' time, the leading economy in the world could be Nigeria, not China. China's maturing. India's starting 8% a year growth. It's going to grow hugely over the next 10 or 15 years, as will Asia. But the long-term future is in Africa. So I think the opportunities are huge, but there's no realization of what we have to do to get there.
Well, you've raised a few interesting points there. I mean, let me just take you back to some of the things that you've just mentioned there. So when you say that you were involved with this European Commission, is this the Critical Raw Minerals Act?
Yes.
So you
speaking, George. I'm not any more involved than that, just commenting on it.
Right.
That was introduced into Ireland in, I think, maybe February of this year was the official launch of it.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, it's irrelevant. It can't work.
Yeah.
Unless they're prepared to fund exploration. But why would a bureaucrat not fund exploration? And the reason is very simple. Because if he recommended to the state that they put the money into high-risk exploration in the salt pans of Botswana, he'd probably be moved to some other position in the west of Ireland or something awful like that. Because it's high-risk money. And bureaucrats do not like risk. And they certainly don't like high risk.
Yes.
And the politicians, no. They're short-term anyway. So they can't see it. And it's very, very difficult to persuade anybody. Indeed, it's very difficult at the moment to persuade sensible investors to invest in high-risk exploration. And it is high-risk.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you do talk about that as well. You talk about how there's a decline in investment. You talk about, you know, from your RNS, again, from your interim statement, you talk about junior stock exchanges, the AIM market in London, Toronto, Australia, they've seen the departure or demise of hundreds of junior explorers. You go on to say, and I quote from you, the cohort of exploration investors has been decimated and will continue to decline. Why is this?
Because it's a couple of things. One is fashion. If you had been a speculative investor, which is the type of investor, man prepared to take, a man or a woman prepared to take high risk in junior explorers, and you have a chance between putting the same type of money into technology companies. Over the last 10 or 15 years, you probably would have done far better to put it into high-spec pharma exploration or high-spec IT exploration. Certainly you would have. And there have been no big, huge, 1,000 times your money back finds in mining as there has been in this. So one of the things is just plain fashion. In the case of the explorers, and the case particularly in the you know, Ireland has a huge boom in the 60s on to the year to 2000s, is we had a cohort of maybe 1,000 explorers, exploration funders. They were great. It was really good when I started.
Yeah.
And these people would fund it. They have got old or died or lost their money, and they're not doing it anymore. People in the 70s and 80s don't want to take long-term projects, you know, for obvious reasons. And the younger ones don't see it. I mean, it includes my own children and other children or friends. They don't see the same thing that we saw when we were 30 or 40.
That's so when you say there's a change in fashion, I mean, do you think that that's, you know, a lot to do with it, for people wanting to invest their money right now? They might be looking for a quick return. They might be looking for something that's more guaranteed. Do you think that has anything to do with it?
I don't know if that's changed. People wouldn't take risk they don't like risk. And they don't like risk with their money. But there was always some people who were prepared to take higher risk for the potential of a higher return. Over the years with the companies I've been in, and it's 50 years now, is you'd say to people, they say to you, high risk means high return. No, it doesn't. High risk means there's a high probability you're going to lose your money. But you have to be prepared to say, well, look, I'm going to take the risk. And if you hit something, you'll make probably 100 or maybe 500 times your money.
Yeah.
That's the risk that you're taking. And it's up to us as explorers to try and reduce the risk as much as possible. Like, for instance, you go, people say, you know, where do you go? You go where the minerals are. You go to the locations where things can be found. And increasingly, they can be either in politically difficult areas or in geographically difficult areas, because a lot of the easier stuff in the West has been found.
Yes.
But that's the type of risk. And it's up to us to try and minimize that kind of risk. But the type of people we want are people who are prepared not to put their entire, you don't want widows and orphans investing in our companies. You really don't. You want people who are prepared to risk a certain part of their money, knowing that they could lose it, but hoping that we have the expertise to be able to deliver a good return. And over a number of years, we did. We had a number of very good hits over a number of years. The zinc industry in Ireland is a good example. Didn't exist into the early 60s, and some returning immigrants from Canada found the first mine. And where I'm sitting now, which is the headquarters of what was Tara Mines, was the biggest zinc discovery in the world in the 20th century. And people made a lot of money out of that for a long number of years. It's still, I think, the fifth biggest zinc mine in the world. So it can work. And for people like me and a declining number of others, we like that particular thing. We think we're able to play the game, take the risk. If we lose, good. We want the wins to offset the losses.
Yes.
But a particular cohort of people who go into early stage exploration, they're like angel investors in startup companies. Same type of thing.
So do you think this is having a knock-on effect in terms of, you know, there's less investors investing, so there's less exploration happening? Do you think there's a relationship there between the two? Or, you know, because you do talk about how mineral exploration has declined in the last decade. You know, you mentioned that in your statement as well. Do you think these are related factors?
Oh, dramatically, yes, of course. I mean, sorry, to me it sounds so obvious, and yet maybe your listeners, it isn't at all obvious. The people who tend to find these are not the big multinationals, no more than the people who discover the new drugs are not the big pharmaceutical companies. They rely on small startups who have fire in their eyes, who are going to go out and do things in the hope of finding some great innovation. Yes, there's no doubt about it. Now, for the last 10 or 12 years, the world has been difficult since 2007. It's been uncertain. And where there's more uncertainty, the less likely of your return. So you tend to shy away from those and maybe look for more of the certainty and guarantee that you were talking about. And but if we don't do it, it won't happen. So what you've seen is increasingly the exploration is moving back towards the large companies who are so bureaucratic, they tend not to find anything. They just don't. But what they have always done and what they will do again, and we give you some examples of it. I mean, Tara Mines was discovered. I was one of the two people in the company. Was eventually bought by Noranda, and then it's now owned by Boliden of Sweden. We discovered a gold diamond mine in Zimbabwe, or in Botswana, get it right, John. And it was taken over by, it's now part of the Lundin Group, a company called Lucara. Because developing a mine and running a mine is not the same as finding a mine.
Yes.
It requires very different skills and things like that.
Yeah.
And also requires more money than the explorers tend to have. But I think it's awful, as I said to you, that the collapse of AIM in London, it's got more bureaucratic, which happens. But there may be 300 or 400 companies have gone from AIM. I think that somebody has said there's 1,700 companies on the Toronto Stock Exchange venture part of it that are gone or have, you know, been subsumed into something. And the ASX, which is the best of the three, the Australian Stock Exchange, is also has lost a lot of companies. It means these are guys and girls and women. In fact, the diamond industry is dominated by the Canadian female explorers. And that won't spend this hard fought for money. And I think the reason for the decline, at least in the exploration, is we cannot raise the seed capital. We cannot raise the money. London was wonderful for a long time. It hasn't been good for the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked, of course, about the Critical Raw Minerals Act that's proposed by the European Commission. And you've mentioned that there's nothing about exploration in that. Just then when you mentioned Canada, and you know, the diamond exploration. Canada is more mining friendly, would you say?
Yes, has been.
But there's still a decline there as well.
Oh, very much so too. Yeah, they developed exploration with a thing called flow-through shares, where, in fact, if you put money into a startup, you could write it off against your tax. Now, AIM has the BES tax relief, which is a plus as well. But it still hasn't stopped. It doesn't matter if you're putting in 100 and you're getting 40 back in tax, you don't want to lose the 60. And if the environment has got tougher and rougher and you don't see the future being as good as it was, you won't put the money in.
Yeah.
They just haven't yet got... Australia's probably even better because the Australian mining sector has been booming completely. And so that's why it's probably doing the best of the three.
Let's stream in, first of all, on different parts of the world. What's happening globally, legislation-wise? Because, of course, we talked about the European Commission. We know Canada is, you know, more friendly in terms of mining. You've mentioned Australia. What's happening in other parts of the world, such as South America, such as, you know, Africa, India, China? What's the global picture in terms of legislation, in terms of exploration?
The first thing that we need, doesn't matter where it is certainty of title. So that if you go in there and you deal with the government, they will give you a license to explore. But you must have the right to that license. That is absolutely critical. And a lot of countries don't have that right. Africa and parts of Africa, East Africa, the former British colonies tend to have very good mineral legislation, really good mineral legislation, where you have certainty of title. In other words, it belongs to you. And it would have to be taken off you by force by the government if they want it, which happens too. So the first thing is that the legislation, the title has to be good. The second thing is the terms have to be sensible and to give you a return. And this can be difficult for bureaucrats because they tend to say to you, oh, you're coming here, so you must know that you're going to discover lithium or zinc. And as such, we want a fair return immediately. Mm-hmm. And of course, you don't know. But yeah. You are really trying to swim up a waterfall, but to say that, and they say, well, why would you be so foolish? The bureaucrats, why would you be so foolish to come over here with your money and to drill a hole when you don't know you're going to find something? And of course, you don't know if you're going to find anything, and most times you don't. But kind of, there are quite a number of the countries we tend to deal in. So we select by that thing. We do not want to go into countries where we have no clear title. We do not want to go in where the terms are so onerous that the government takes everything. Now, as a country matures, the level of risk can go down. So if you do find lithium in these countries, or diamonds, or zinc, the lithium the terms get tighter over time because the risk goes down that you're going to find. So there are plenty of countries still. There's 240 jurisdictions in the world where we can lose our money exploring through. Now, a lot of them, Western Europe is very difficult. It's to the environmental considerations. Not that they're bad, it's just that they take forever to put in place. So you're waiting. So very few countries in the Western world is it a good place to explore. I was aware of one project, I think it was in Nevada in the States, which required 95 permits.
And how long would each permit take to
work? You could work it. Actually, that's the funny thing. Probably not as long as it would take in some of the countries here, like my own one here, to get planning permission. So you could work out the whole lot of them at once. It was a gold project. I think it actually went into production, but we walked a mile from that. We know we did. We walked a couple of thousand miles from it. But a lot of the countries are easy to work. And then the third thing is that you have an environment that is conducive to it. Do you have local... Is there any kind of an infrastructure? Because if there's no infrastructure, you have to build it.
Yes.
That's very costly and there's no return on it. If you have to build a road into the desert, which we do in Botswana,
that's right.
There's no water. Some of the places you have to bring in the water, which is very expensive. No power lines. So you have to bring in diesel, which is still very expensive. Now, solar is going to solve that in most places very quickly.
Yeah.
And so the technology is fixing it. And so it's a very difficult business, but the environment is changing all the time. Different governments change. When suddenly the mining industry disappears, when they won't invest anymore and the mines run out, the country says, well, what are we going to do? They have to change the legislation to attract the explorers and then the miners.
Yeah. Well, you know, you talk about And you're quite right there, John. 3 billion people, and I'm quoting you again from your statement, are likely to enter the middle class in the coming decades, all wanting the type of life followed by those of us living in the West. So this is not a small amount of people. Why do you think it is that globally this is not being acknowledged in terms of, well, we need exploration there? Because these people, you know, first of all, let's bring it back to these 3 billion people. What parts of the world are we talking about here?
Oh, it's phenomenal. And in fact, the question you just asked, you're absolutely right. How have we not recognized the growth of, say, China, for instance?
Yeah.
China is now the biggest car market in the world. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest EVs in the world. 20 million cars a year, 50% greater than the United States. It takes something like 60% of all the iron ore in the world. Now, that's too much. Mm-hmm. It's going there. So in terms of a very simple thing, the first year you're happening here is you see Asia. This is kind of known. It's not me being mad. Asia, you'll have 550 million Chinese coming into the middle class now. They're there and growing. Yeah. The next huge one is India, where 800 million people. It's growing at 80%. India is now where China was 30 years ago. And you can't stop it. You just can't stop this.
It's moving fast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 8% a year is fast. Mm-hmm. And maybe even faster. They have big bureaucracy problems and things like that. But you cannot stop the movement of people. You just cannot. So, and they have wonderful technology. I mean, the Indians, the lithium technology that you would have talked to my colleague about, the new extractive, the lithium extraction, is being fostered in India as we speak. Right now, the first plant is in operation in India. Their technology is really good. But the other areas that you could ignore, it's your parallel there. You have the Philippines with a couple of 100 million people, a lot of whom are already middle class. Thailand, a huge market, 200 million people plus. You have Pakistan, Indonesia, all of these with hundreds of millions, much bigger than anything we have here. But that will take you for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
South America, again, Brazil is starting to use its muscle. Not really big enough, 300 million people. It's a shocking thing to say, not really big enough. And it needs, South America, which was very rich 120 years ago, is no longer very rich, which is awful. Mm. Unfortunately, it put it down to really bad management, bad politicians, just not able to see the long picture, the long picture. They want everything to happen very quickly. Mm. So Latin America is going to grow, but the future, a larger number of people think that the future will be in Africa, whereby 2100, which is 70 years from now, there'll be over 1 billion people. Actually, I think it might be 1.5 billion, because some estimates think that Nigeria could have 1 billion people itself. It's expected to have 500 million people by 2050. Ethiopia, hundreds of millions of people. Already you can see, I mean, Lagos and places like that, massive operations already. So as you can see, I'm kind of well sold on this. East Africa now is growing fast. Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. These countries are growing really fast. Mm. Now, they have huge infrastructure problems, which is an opportunity. You should build roads, and you have to put in electricity pylons. You've got to put in all the infrastructure that we want. But this is a big, big opportunity and will require huge resources.
Yes. Now, John, you've talked about how exploration is declining. You talked about how the investors are declining. However, you do say in your statement that you see a bright future in mining. Yes. You know, you talk about how you're an optimist and that's why you're in this field. But, you know, you also talk about how the picture is clouded by well-meaning, and I quote you, uninformed commentators who want all mining stopped. Now, what do you mean by this? Why are they uninformed? In what way?
They don't accept. You only have to look at the next time you see a lot of demonstrators, and you'll see people saying, just stop oil. Would somebody tell me how you could do that? Are we all going to go back to bicycles? And if we're going back to bicycles, we'll have to have the metals to build the bicycles. So if we stop mining, there'll be no bicycles. Now, why can't they not see that? It is beyond me. It really is beyond me that they can't see that particular thing. But they don't want to know. Now, certainly what's being done is they are causing us to think and to adapt and to change. And that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But there will be a realization. And it's happening already at the corporate level that, look, these things have to move at the rate of possible. I think what's going to happen, why I'm optimistic, is I think the prices of these metals are going to rise.
Yeah.
And when the prices rise, if you think about it now, they look more attractive to speculators. And so more money will come back into our business, as it must. The government can't run exploration companies. So I hope they don't all decide we're going to do exploration companies. The number of bureaucrats to have, there'll be more bureaucrats than will be geologists. So that's not a factor. You can't do that. They need to get individuals who are prepared to risk their own money and other monies that they can bring together on that. It's essential that they have to have skin in the game.
Yeah. So what would you say, you know, when you talk about, for example, stop oil, what would you say to people that say, you know what, it can cause environmental effects. It can cause things like leaks into the water supply, earth tremors from mining, you know, the actual effects that the mining has on the environment. How do you balance that?
You just said it. How do you balance it? You're exactly right. So, one, you cannot stop it. They think you're going to stop it. It cannot stop, or the world will stop.
Yes.
And the 3 billion people who want to have electricity in their home, who want to have running water, who want to have cars, not necessarily bicycles, they're not going to listen to you. It's all very well sitting down in Trafalgar Square or sitting down in O'Connor Street here in Dublin. But, you know, you're not the one. You go home to your home that is centrally heated, using amazing. And we don't have much, we won't have any solar today. And they will drive home somehow. A lot of them are, as they'll take a bus. They're not going to walk home.
Yeah.
So, yes, have we damaged the environment? Yes, we have. Are we going to fix the environment? Yes, we are. I have absolute explicit belief that the ability of man to develop technologies that will stop that. And you can see it happening already. Yeah. There are technologies happening, particularly you see it in the generation of electricity.
Yes.
I read just this morning that 92% of UK electricity last month could have been generated from wind. I mean, that's a number that most of us wouldn't have believed possible. Mm-hmm. So they will solve that problem. But to do that, you need batteries. Batteries require a huge amount of metals, the big heavy metal things, and even bigger amounts of lithium. But nobody said that. But it will happen. And yes, you have to stop the damage. But what will happen is technology and people will adapt to that, knowing what has to be done. Mm. Again, I saw it this morning. They have a new design. A startup in the US has a new aircraft, a new plane that is shaped like the stealth bombers, like a bat, in fact.
Right.
Require 70% less fuel.
Wonderful.
70%. And that will happen.
That's now, remarkable.
It's early stages and things like that. But things like wind, solar, electric cars, which 20 or 30 or 40 years ago were probably at the same stage that this new aircraft is, will happen. Mm. No, and so it should happen. But just stopping it just doesn't make any sense. And we and people younger than me now have to go in and find the resources that are necessary to enable the transition to happen. And I really believe I'm kind of an open market economist originally, that if we incentivize people, just incentivize them, and they tend to be incentivized with money.
Yes.
Maybe not with philanthropy. I know I'd be in trouble over that. If they see that there's money to be made by putting their efforts and their brains and their scarce cash into that, it will work. It has always worked and it will work.
Mm-hmm. You also mention in your statement that in an uncertain world, people buy gold. They've done so for 4,000 years and they're doing it again. I mean, gold prices are testing all-time highs. Now, this is something that has stood the test of time. Why do you think gold prices are an all-time high now?
Uncertain world. And the world is very uncertain. In fact, even in the last few days, it's getting more uncertain.
Absolutely.
People buy gold when they're worried. Central banks buy gold because it is so-called store of value.
Yeah.
Gold will always maintain a value. You don't worry about the commercial, industrial uses of gold. It's very small. But what you see for the last few years at $2,500 an ounce, that's a lot of money for an ounce.
Now, of course, you know, just to state the obvious, this is something as well that needs to be mined.
Well, there are lots of gold mines at a price. Absolutely. We have gold discoveries here in Arkle over almost 40 years now. We've been exploring for gold, but it would be high cost and environmentally difficult, and you'd have to do things. So it would just be high cost to do it within the regulations. Mm. But the opportunities are good. And at the current price, it's probably viable. But you can't base a 5 or a 10 year plan on the current price of really anything. You have to be able to project it out into the future. But certainly gold is maintaining around the world that it is a store of value. Mm-hmm. And it will. It never tarnishes, never gets rusty. So when you find a gold coin from 4,000 years ago, it's exactly the same. You just clean the muck off it and it's exactly the same as it was 4,000 years ago. It's incredible.
That's something that fascinates me, actually.
And me too, still.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, we have jewelry that might be passed down from generation to generation, and you just think, you know, or when you even when you go out and buy gold, you think, you know, how many times has this been?
Yes.
Maybe refashioned, redone.
Yes. It doesn't change. If it does get tarnished in any way, it's shiner.
Yeah.
And it's as good as it ever was. It isn't amazing. Yes, it still fascinates me.
So, in terms of course, just to finish off, you know, looking at the dilemma there, as we've been talking about with mining at the moment, do you think it's getting greener? Do you think the practices are getting greener?
Dramatically. Not even in a small way, dramatically. One simple one I mentioned to you, in Botswana, we will use solar power to generate electricity. We will not use diesel, which has to trundle in small trucks across the sands. Hugely inefficient. They'll do that. You can adapt the technologies to improve. I think most of the miners, and I believe them, they say, the big ones that say they'll be net zero by 2050. I think that'll happen. Mm-hmm. You can do it. You can use electric trucks, trackless vehicles, they're called underground, on huge monster trucks that run on big batteries. Okay, we need the batteries, so back to that. Mm-hmm. But that, they, yes, and I think the processing will improve. Now, I think it's a good idea that it has to improve anyway. I mean, if it makes your production process far more efficient, that's a good thing. It doesn't matter whether you're doing it for any kind of reason. Yeah. And I would be perfectly, you'd love to see more developments in exploration. We saw one, we had a joint venture with a Russian company some years ago, not at the moment, obviously. And they were wonderful. They actually brought mobile analysis labs out into the bush. So what happened is you go out and you take your samples, you bring them back. Normally you'd have to transport them a long way to another country to get them processed. These people had a mobile lab. So within 48 hours, you had the results, which meant that your exploration was much better directed, but also saved a huge amount on the environment. That kind of stuff will happen. And I haven't the slightest doubt that over the coming 20 years, maybe driven on by some of the objectors and those looking for it will help. But it will have to be sustaining. You cannot take people's money and lose it for them in the name of anything. You know, if we're investing money in any of our exploration ventures now, we have to offer them the chance of a good return. We're not doing it for the good of the earth. You're doing it for the good of the shareholders' money. You have to, if you lose that objective, people will not give you their money. They want to be careful it doesn't put people off investing in these industries, which it has. Some people will say, well, now look, I'm not going to give my money into that because I don't trust it. Or maybe your children are objecting or something like that. So we have to try and ensure that there will be a certain cohort, at least, are prepared to do it on the belief that it's incentivized, that it is going to become green, which it will, it must. But there are certain steps that are needed to get there.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, these are not short term investments. These are
not at all.
Plans.
Not at all. That's one of the big worries about the thing in general. Modern finance now, it's a totally different topic for a different day. Finance, because of the private equity and the hedge funds, tends to be short term, 5 years, 6 years. They learned all this at business school, 5 year payback. Mining, exploration and mining is not a 5 year payback. That said, I was made aware of one small diamond mine in Botswana, owned by De Beers, that had its payback of 3.5 days. Now, that was nice. I've never seen anything like that. Usually, from the time you start, you're 8 to 12 years at best. And that's a very long time. So only a certain cohort of risk-taking investors will make that. That's not going to change. Mm. It's always going to be long-term.
Mm. Well, let's have a look at your project now. John, of course, it's fascinating speaking to you about the global picture. And but let's just finish off by looking at what's happening with your ARCOL projects, because, of course, you've talked about lithium being so important moving forward, and you're actually mining for lithium in Botswana. Where are you up to with that?
I'd love to be mining. I'm exploring.
Exploring, sorry.
I would deeply love to be mining. We're very blessed because we've been operating in Botswana with different companies now for over 20 years. And we realized that the future for lithium lies in lithium brines, which is salty water that comes out, and the salts contain lithium. It's a very different mining operation to the hard rock lithium that you will be doing in Ireland or we will be doing in Zimbabwe, where, you know, you're digging it out and rigging holes and all that kind of, and using hydro pyrometallurgical ways of actually to get the lithium. So it's the brines. They're salt pans, 24,000 kilometers of square kilometers of salt pans in Botswana. We got two licenses there. Again, it took a while and we got them. Very good environment. And we did the first kind of electromagnetic surveys over it and found that there were brines there. Now, there should have been, because rivers come into the Kalahari and then they're evaporated, and what you have is salt pans, large salt pans. And we've just finished about now a small sampling program to take samples of the brines, which is salty water. So we take them in containers. We're shipping those at the moment. We're shipping them to Brisbane, but to get people to do this, where we'll test to see, do they contain lithium? And then the next sampling program will be see to get the grade. You'd have high expectations of that. It's a very good, we have a good team. We've had to learn because lithium exploration is new for most of us.
That's right.
So we've been learning how to do that. The team there are good. The second very active program we have was the genesis of ARCO, which is the zinc in Ireland. And Ireland is a major zinc producer.
And this is on Stone Park.
Stone Park in Limerick. It is next door, like 50 yards away from a very large discovery by Glencore, 45 million tons of zinc. It's literally on the other side of the main road, 50 yards away. And we have 5.1 million tons of 11%. That's good. That's high grade, but not enough in an expensive environment like an advanced country like this. So we have a partner, Group 11, that are the operator and have 76% of it. And they have been working on two blocks of licenses to the southeast of us. And they've discoveries on that. And now they are drilling in the southern part of our block. They're drilling four holes. It's ongoing now to test out what has the mineralization. They should find it. They've done enough earlier prospecting work to say that it's there, in the hope that this could be joined with their discoveries in a place called Ballywire and Carrickittle.
Right.
Looking for a bigger deposit. So the drilling will be finished by the end of this year, results sometime next year. So it's active at the moment, which is good. Maybe that's why I was optimistic in the statement, is that we're doing okay. I'm very comfortable with what we're doing in Botswana, and I'm delighted to see the drilling in Stone Park.
Yeah, and you also have lithium in Ireland and in Zimbabwe as well.
We've just finished, literally over the weekend, a survey on three small licenses in Zimbabwe. These are spodumene or lepidolite, hard rock licenses. Zimbabwe is the third biggest exporter of hard rock lithium ore in the world. It's not known at all. And difficult environment. And so you have to go where the minerals are. And we did, because, again, we've experience of working in Zimbabwe for 40 years now. And I will have the results of that. All we're trying to find there, and that there is lithium in the rocks. And if there is, we'd look to joint venture with some of the companies around us. I would hope that could happen fairly quickly.
And gold in Ireland as well. You're also very focused on that. How's that going?
We've been at it for 40 years. Can you believe, since 1986? So, 38 years in the area just south of us here, maybe 40 kilometers directly south of me on a good day, and it's not, I can see the hills, and I can't see them at the moment. We've had some very good gold grades. It's narrow veins in Ireland, so the veins tend to be high quality. But we have traced out over the years 7 kilometer vein, a good vein in a known gold area. In 1803 there was a big gold rush in this area called Avoca. People have been looking for the source since. We have some good, we've drilled a lot of holes over the years there. And when you have a nuggety gold, I don't know if you know that, in other words, the gold is not spread evenly throughout the rock. It comes in nuggets, as does diamonds. And you can drill a hole and find great results, which we have. We've won 51 grams per ton, and we thought we were rich. And then the next hole is nothing. Because two things can happen. The veins bend, And they also swell and narrow. So the area needs more work to be done there. We went to the north of Ireland, right, the northern part of Ireland, a place called Donegal, where we found rocks that are similar to the Dalradium discovery in Tyrone, in the north of Ireland, where there's 6 million ounces. Good discovery. Found what we were looking for. We drilled four holes in December 22. All four found mineralization, with, again, tracing one vein. So it needs, it's a question we don't, it's struggling to raise the money to run all three programs, you know, gold, lithium, and zinc. So you have to prioritize. And at the moment, even with the high gold prices, the lithium is by far a better prospect we regard.
Yeah. So you're focusing on the lithium. And is that lithium in Botswana that you're more
focused on? Lithium in Botswana. Yeah, exactly. Because it's an 837 square kilometer block. So there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
Brines on it are 10 meters thick, 30 feet thick, which is good. Now, we have to say that one, it has lithium. Two, it has grades. And three, it doesn't have impurities. But we'll be doing that over the next 5 or 6 months.
Well, no doubt, John, we'll be talking to you again to find out how that's all going, hear the latest developments from ARCL. But it's been absolutely fascinating to speak to you today, just to, you know, dig a little deeper into what's happening with exploration and mining globally, looking at the global picture. So thank you very much for your time today, John.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.